Hello, this is Sonia Sasseville, and echoing Jean, welcome to the webinar on the proposal for CERCLA Section 108B regulations for the hard rock mining industry. The purpose of the webinar today is to give you a basic overview of the proposed regulation, which will hopefully make it a little bit easier as you wade through and try to review and develop comments. We also will try to answer some questions, hopefully clear up confusion. It's a challenge to try to, through an hour webinar, rulemaking that's fairly significant in length, so we're hoping to hit the highlights and just, as I said, make it a little bit easier for you to go through it. One of the things, as we mentioned, that as Jean mentioned, that we did was we also provided in related links basically the table of contents of the rule. You may, especially if you haven't gotten into the rule too much yet, you may find it useful to have that on another screen or to print it and just follow along with that as we walk you through. Okay, I'm trying to advance the slide.
You may need to click the arrows on the lower left corner of the slide window to get started.
And it worked. Okay, wrong arrows. Okay, so here we have just a basic outline of the presentation. As I mentioned, we plan to just walk you through the sections of the regulation, highlighting how it's structured and some of the key provisions. And we appreciate receiving a number of questions ahead of time. What we're going to do is some of those are answers are essentially woven into the presentation. We'll answer some of them as we end certain sections of the presentation, and then there'll be more that we answer at the end, and at that point we can also potentially get to questions that you may type in during the webinar. Okay, so as far as some background, on December 1st, the EPA Administrator signed for publication two actions under CERCLA 108B. First, a proposed rule that would require owners and operators of certain facilities within the hard rock mining industry to demonstrate financial responsibility to cover CERCLA liabilities at their sites, and a notice of intent to proceed with rulemaking on additional classes of facilities within three industry sectors: chemical manufacturing, petroleum and coal products manufacturing, and the electric power generation, transmission, and distribution sector. Both of these actions were signed in compliance with an order issued on January 29, 2016 by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. The proposed hard rock mining rule and the notice of intent for the additional classes are scheduled for publication in the Federal Register tomorrow. That's Wednesday, January 11th. EPA did post the day after signature a copy of the pre-publication version of both the hard rock mining proposed rule and the notice of intent for additional classes. So those are already available along with several of the key background documents associated with the rulemaking for hard rock mining. Once the rule is published in the Federal Register, those pre-publications, which are not official, will go away and you'll be able to get to the Federal Register version. There also today is posted on the Federal Register website the pre-publication version of the rule, the proposed rule. Publication of the proposed rule will trigger a 60-day public comment period, which will end on March 12, 2017. Instructions for submitting public comments are contained within the proposal in the preamble in the addresses section. The notice of intent to proceed with rulemaking on additional classes of facilities is not a request for comment. Opportunity for public comment will be provided during the rulemaking processes addressing those industry classes. So the remainder of this webinar will focus on the key provisions of the proposed hard rock mining rule. To give you a brief overview, EPA's first rule under the Section 108B authority, the proposed rule would establish a financial responsibility program within Superfund, codified at 40 CFR Part 320. And you can see the key subparts of the rule. The proposed rule would establish within Part 320, Subpart A, which would contain general facility requirements, Subpart B for general financial responsibility requirements, Subpart C for available financial responsibility instruments, and Subpart H, which is specific to hard rock mining facilities. So Subparts A, B, and C include foundational components of the CERCLA Section 108B Financial Responsibility Program that EPA is proposing. They would be applicable to the hard rock mining facility subject to the proposed rule, and EPA expects that they would also serve as the foundation for future rulemakings under CERCLA Section 108B. So commenters that may not be so interested in hard rock mining but are interested in those other sectors may want to focus on subparts A, B, and C. Subpart H requirements would be applicable specifically to the hard rock mining facilities. And with that, I'll turn it over to Linda Barr to go over subpart A.
Okay, thank you, Sonia. Subpart A covers general facility requirements. Section 320.2 addresses applicability of the proposed rule. Owners and operators of facilities that are authorized to operate or should be authorized to operate on or after the effective date of the rule under which they first become subject to Part 320 requirements would be required to comply with the provisions of the rule. The requirements of Part 320 would apply until EPA releases the owner or operator from its obligation to maintain financial responsibility. Section 320.1b covers the purpose and scope of the proposed rule. In this section, it would require covered facilities to establish the amount of financial responsibility consistent with the degree and duration of risk associated with the production, transportation, treatment, storage, or disposal of hazardous substances at the facility, and must be available to pay for the response costs, health assessment costs, and natural resource damages under CERCLA for which the owner or operator is responsible. Section 320.5 outlines the notification requirements of the proposed rule. And in this section, owners and operators would be required to submit a notification to EPA within 30 days of the effective date of the regulation that first makes the facility subject to Part 320 requirements. Section 320.6 lays out the general information submission requirements that facilities would have to provide to EPA. Section 320.7 addresses requirements for electronic submission of information. And in this section, owners and operators would be required to submit information in paper format until an electronic reporting compliance date by which submission in electronic format would be required. EPA will announce this date through the Federal Register notice. Section 320.8 covers record-keeping requirements. Requirements for owners and operators will need to develop a facility record that contains information related to compliance with Part 320 requirements. Section 320.9 addresses the requirements for public notice. Section EPA has presented two possible approaches. Approach one, owners and operators would be required to establish and make information available to the public on a CERCLA Section 108B Financial Responsibility Information website. Under Approach 2, EPA would provide information to the public, including facility contact information and non-confidential business information, or CBI, submitted by the facility to EPA. And for this section, we have received a question, and that question is, what happens if a covered entity cannot provide the required assurance due to lack of funds or no available market mechanisms or other issues? In response, if the owner or operator does not require financial assurance, they would not be in compliance with the rule and would be subject to enforcement by EPA. However, this would be addressed in the enforcement process as appropriate.
And consideration would be given to what the issue is, for example, if it is something like mechanisms not being available.
Right. So. Okay, and at this point, I will hand it over to Mike Pease, who will cover subpart B.
Thanks, Linda. Thanks, everybody, for joining today. So subpart B covers the general financial responsibility requirements. Section 320.20, applicable financial responsibility amounts. This section would require that owners and operators would be required to calculate a financial responsibility amount based on class-specific requirements. For hard rock mining facilities, those requirements are found in subpart H. Section 320.22, maintenance of instruments. This section includes requirements that owners and operators would be required to recalculate the financial responsibility amount 3 years after the date they are first required to submit the full amount of financial responsibility, and every 3 years thereafter, and within 60 days after a successful claim against the financial responsibility instrument. Additionally, the section includes that the provision would also provide for adjustments of the financial responsibility instrument. Section 320.23, incapacity of owners or operators, financial institutions. This section would require owners and operators to notify EPA within 10 days of the commencement of voluntary or involuntary proceedings under Title 11, Bankruptcy, the U.S. Code, the named owner or operator as debtor. It would also require the owners and operators to provide evidence of other financial responsibility within 60 days in the event of incapacity of an instrument provider. Continuing with subpart B, sections 320.24, notifications of claims brought against owners, operators, or guarantors. This section would require owners and operators to notify EPA of the filing of any claim pursuant to CERCLA, naming the owner or operator, or the owner or operator's guarantor as defendant. Section 320.25, facility transfer. This provision would require owners or operators to maintain financial responsibility for a facility or portion of a facility that is transferred until released from that obligation by EPA. Additionally, it would require a new owner or operator of a facility or portion of a facility to provide evidence of financial responsibility prior to assuming ownership or operation. Section 320.26, notification of cessation of operations. This section would require that owners or operators would be required to notify EPA 30 days prior to, one, the date the facility is no longer authorized to operate, or two, the date the owner or operator is required under another applicable regulatory program to notify the relevant regulatory authority that the facility is ceasing operations, whichever is earlier. Section 320.27, release from financial responsibility requirements. This section would allow an owner or operator EPA for release from its obligations under Part 320 by submitting evidence to demonstrate that the degree and duration of risk associated with the management of hazardous substances at the facility is minimal. EPA would evaluate facility information, including information submitted by the owner or operator, and make a determination if EPA determines that the degree and duration of risk associated with the management of hazardous substances at the facility is minimal and that the facility should be released from financial responsibility requirements, EPA would post its draft decision on the agency's website and provide opportunity for public comment and post its response to comment and final decision on the EPA website. If, on the other hand, EPA determines that the degree and duration of risk associated with the management of hazardous substances is not minimal, EPA would provide the owner or operator a detailed written statement explaining the decision and provide notice of final decision and its response to comments received. Moving on to subpart C, this subpart covers the available financial responsibility instruments. The proposed rule provides the following financial responsibility instruments: letter of credit with regulations at section 320.40, surety bond with regulations at section 320.41, insurance in section 320.42, as an option, the financial test in section 320.43. Also an option is a corporate guarantee in section 320.44 and a trust fund in section 320.45. The rule proposes two options for the use of a financial test and corporate guarantee. The first would be to not allow the use of a financial test and corporate guarantee. This is EPA's preferred option. The second would be to allow the use of a credit rating-based financial test and corporate guarantee. For each of the financial responsibility instruments, subpart C of the proposed rule includes regulations establishing requirements for the owner's or operator's demonstration of financial responsibility and required instrument language. It can be found in section 320.50. The conditions for payment of the letter of credit, surety bond, insurance, corporate guarantee, and trust fund instruments are included in the required wording of the instruments in section 320.50. Generally, funds from those financial responsibility instruments would be available to pay a final judgment from a federal court awarding CERCLA response costs, health assessment costs, and or natural resource damages, for a CERCLA settlement with agencies of the federal government, including but not limited to administrative settlement and consent decrees, and into a trust fund established under a unilateral administrative order. Additionally, note that under CERCLA Section 108C, parties, including EPA, could also bring a direct action claim against the instrument provider. These payment provisions are discussed in Section Roman numeral 6B5. Of the preamble, titled General Provisions on Instrument Payment. Continuing with subpart C, we'll just highlight a few of the notable instrument provisions included in this subpart. The proposed financial responsibility instruments would be specified to pay to any and all third-party CERCLA claimants. One exception is that two acceptable specifications of the letter of credit are provided for, including one that would pay to the trustee of a trust fund that would hold the letter of credit. This requirement is discussed in section Roman 6C1 of the preamble. Another notable instrument provision is instrument issuer cancellation provisions. These provisions include the potential requirement for the instrument provider to fund a standby trust, or in the case of a corporate guarantor, obtain alternate financial responsibility in the name of the owner or operator. The cancellation provisions are intended to ensure continuity of financial responsibility coverage and provide assurance that funds will be available when necessary. This requirement is discussed at section Roman 6C7 of the preamble and individually for each instrument in section Roman 6C of the preamble. Moving on with additional notable provisions, surety bonds and corporate guarantees would only be allowed to satisfy the requirements if the attorneys general or insurance commissioners of, one, the state in which the surety/guarantor is incorporated, And two, each state in which the facility covered by the instrument is located have submitted a written statement to EPA that the instrument executed as described in the regulations is a legally valid and enforceable obligation in that state. Multiple insurers may cover a single facility, and surety bonds may be issued by multiple sureties, provided that each issuer is liable for its individual vertical percentage share of the instrument. These specifications are discussed in sections Roman 6, C3, in a subsection titled Multiple Insurers, and Roman 6, C2, in a subsection titled Multiple Sureties. An owner or operator would be allowed to use a financial responsibility instrument to demonstrate financial responsibility for more than one facility. This provision is discussed in section Roman numeral 6, C9 of the preamble titled Use of a Financial Instrument for Multiple Facilities. The proposal discusses and requests comment on the use of captive insurance and risk retention groups. This discussion can be found in section Roman 6, C3, in a subsection titled Issuer Eligibility. And I'll pause here. We've had some questions come in about subpart C. I'll answer a few of them here. We had a couple related to to trust funds and the trust fund language. One asking if the proposed trust agreement language was based on any previous trust language. And another question from separate commenter asking if what type of outreach we had done to the trust institutions. I'll start with the sample, the model trust language included in the proposal. That was, we did have previous trust language to help guide us. The RIC Subtitle C financial assurance regulations have model trusts that we looked at. Those can be found at 40 CFR 264-151. A, M, and N. And for more information on the development of the trust language, the background document on instrument specifications has more information. Regarding the outreach done to trust organizations, we did conduct outreach. We met with and discussed with entities in the trust industry the agency's thinking as to the operation of the trust fund instrument. Those discussions were helpful for EPA and informed the language of the proposed trust agreement. Notes from those discussions will be in the docket. One of the overarching comments we received was the trustee expenses may be higher in this type of construction where there isn't one identified beneficiary. And now it's kind of at a good time that the entire rule is out for public review and for comment. We're very interested in further comment from the financial community as to the likely availability of the instruments being proposed. We also had a comment asking if a surety steps in, whether or not they are FPP or if there's a cap on their FR liability. And to answer this, I guess I'd say that CERCLA 108D does generally provide that the total liability of any guarantor in a direct action suit is limited to the aggregate amount of the limits of the policy of the instrument. And that the proposed terms of the instruments are intended to reflect this limitation. Further, the proposed instrument terms are also intended to include a similar limit under the other payment scenarios as well, that being those that are outside of the direct action scenario. With that, I'll...
Actually, this is Sonia Sasseville. I noticed that we have a number of questions coming in related to the financial responsibility formula, asking what is the formula referenced in 320-63, and you know, with some questions about that. So we maybe should mention this up front, but there will be a separate webinar in at the end of January, January 30th, that will be specifically on the financial responsibility formula. The question of what it is the formula that allows a facility to calculate the financial responsibility amount that they would be required to assure for under rule. So facilities would look at the formula, submit the information required, and also do the calculation to calculate their required financial responsibility amount, as well as submit the information backing up the inputs into the formula. So again, there will be a webinar on January 30th, and if you're interested in more detail on the formula, we would encourage you to sign up for that. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks,
Anya. Hi, and we're moving on to subpart H now. These are the industry-specific requirements applicable to hard rock mining facilities. Subpart H includes proposed requirements that would apply to owners or operators of facilities within the hard rock mining industry. I'm going to cover three main areas of subpart H. Applicability at 3/20/60, timeframes for compliance at 3/20/61, and determining the financial responsibility amount at 3/20/63. We'll also refer to the definitions section in 3/20/62. In 3/20/60 applicability, the proposed rule would apply to classes of facilities within the hard rock mining industry that were identified by EPA in a July 28, 2009 Federal Register Notice 74 FR 37213, except for mines conducting only placer mining activities as defined in Section 3/20/62, mines conducting only exploration activities as defined in Section 3/20/62, mines with a disturbance as defined in 3/20/62 of less than 5 acres located within a mile of mine disturbance that occurred in the prior 10-year period and that do not employ hazardous substances in their processes, and mineral processors as defined in 3/20/62 with less than 5 acres of surface impoundment and waste pile disturbance. Owners or operators of facilities that conduct only these limited activities would not be required to comply with the requirements of Part 320. Under 3/20/61, timeframes for compliance, owners or operators would be required to comply with the following timeframes for demonstrating financial responsibility. The amount of health assessment cost component by 24 months after promulgation of the final rule. 50% of the response and natural resource damages cost components by 36 months after promulgation of the final rule. And the full amount of the response and natural resource damage cost components by 48 months after the promulgation of the final rule. And I'll pause right now to address some of the questions that we received in advance. EPA was asked whether the requirements of the proposed rule would apply to those portions of an active facility, for example, open pits, waste piles, roads, etc., where hard rock mining operations were but no longer are authorized because the areas have been closed and reclaimed and all bonds have been released. So in response, owners and operators would be required to include in the calculation of the financial responsibility amount those site features that are authorized to operate or should be authorized to operate. The areas that are not authorized to operate would not be included in the calculation. It's worth noting, however, that the proposed rule would not affect the owners and operators' liabilities in any way, including at those areas. The next question, EPA has been asked whether the requirements of the proposed rule would apply to those portions of a facility potentially covered by the rule where the entire facility is subject to RCRA corrective action requirements imposed by a RCRA permit and the facility has identified and addressed all SWMUs, begun implementing corrective action, potential assurance for corrective action. In response, the applicable RCRA requirements could be submitted by the owner or operator, as could any other federal or state requirements, as part of a demonstration that they qualify for a reduction under Section 32063 and would be evaluated by EPA. And now I'm going to move to discussion of determining the financial responsibility amount under 32063. Owners or operators of hard rock mining facilities would be required to calculate a financial responsibility amount using a formula provided in 32063. Owners or operators would be able to satisfy components of the formula by demonstrating that they are subject to and in compliance with requirements that will result in minimum degree and duration of risk associated with the management of hazardous substances at a site feature, that their obligation to implement such requirements is imposed in an enforceable document, and that they have demonstrated and are required to demonstrate adequate financial responsibility to assure implementation of the requirements, and certifying that they are in compliance with the requirements. There'll be more information on the financial responsibility formula in our upcoming webinar on January 30th of this year. In this webinar, EPA will conduct an overview of the financial responsibility formula for the proposed rule under CERCLA Section 108B for classes of facilities in the hard rock mining industry. EPA has set up an electronic mailbox for participants to submit questions prior to the webinar. However, due to the volume of questions anticipated, EPA may not be able to respond to all questions. Advanced questions may be submitted by January 23, 2017 to 108B webinar questions at epa.gov, which is the same mailbox that you could submit questions for this webinar, with the subject line, Financial Responsibility Formula Webinar. Do not submit comments on the proposed rule to this email box. To ensure EPA considers them, comments on the proposed rule must be submitted in accordance with the instructions provided in the published version of the proposed rule in the Federal Register. And the webinar registration is included on this page below.
This is Sonia. One more thing regarding questions on the financial responsibility formula. The questions that people submitted for this webinar that were specific to the formula will be carried over to the questions set for the next webinar. So if you have already submitted comments on the formula, you're welcome to submit them again, but no need to. We will consider those questions and try to answer them to the extent we can when we present the financial responsibility formula webinar.
And with that, we'll take questions.
Okay, I believe the team's going to review some of the questions that have been submitted. And while they're reading through some of those questions, I just wanted to remind the live audience, you can continue to submit your comments and questions for today's presenters by submitting them in the Q&A window, which should appear towards the middle lower right of your screen. You can click on the empty box at the bottom of that window, type up your message, and then hit the Enter key on your keyboard. Again, we'll be rejoined by the team here live on the line in just a moment, where they'll begin reading through some of the questions and start to verbally address them. We may not be able to address all questions live today, but we will continue to encourage you to send in your questions and comments. We'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that's allotted today. Some of you have asked a few general questions about the webinar. If the materials are currently available for download, they are available right now for download from the webinar resources page. You can find that under the related URLs window towards the middle right of your screen. If you scroll through there, you'll see a link to the seminar resources. Simply click on that and press the Browse to button. Some of you have asked if you can obtain CEUs or PDHs for participating today. We do not formally offer CEUs or PDHs for our webinars, but you may be able to earn credit with your own institution by documenting your participation in today's session. So again, questions or comments can be submitted into that Q&A window towards the middle right of your screen. And when the team is ready to resume with the live broadcast, they'll go ahead and take themselves off of mute, and they'll begin reading through some of the questions out loud to try to verbally respond to those questions and comments. Before we close out today's live broadcast, we will walk through a series of very brief reminders, again, indicating how you can access the materials, as well as how you can provide feedback for today's live broadcast. You'll find those types of resources already linked under the Related URLs window towards the middle right of your screen.
Thanks, Jean.
Resume? Great. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so we had one question that I'll start with that came in. What is the reason for requiring the statement from the insurance commissioner or the attorney general that the bond is enforceable? That's one of the subpart C kind of provisions for the surety bond, and is actually proposed for the corporate guarantee as well. That stems from kind of our past experience and some concern that a bond written as required in the proposal might implicate state insurance law, and thus the validity of any such bond may depend on state law. That's come up in other EPA rulemakings. If folks are curious, the RCRA Subtitle C third-party liability requirements developed in like the mid to late 80s and the underground storage tanks programs had to deal with this issue. And basically, since the state insurance regulation is kind of all handled at the state level, the agency didn't feel like it could state with any certainty that any particular bond would subject the issuer to state insurance law and whether or not it would thus be valid. So we wanted that assurance from the state attorney general or insurance commissioner. And this is all discussed in the preamble in both the surety bond and the corporate guarantee section. And it is it's definitely an area where we've asked for comments too.
Well, we received some questions relating to subpart H, specifically about the meaning, about some definitions in subpart H, specifically about the meaning of process pond and tailing ponds in the regulations. The definitions for these are laid out in 320.62, and we're not able to expand on them right now, but we've...
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 5 minutes.
We have 5 minutes.
Hi, folks. Can you still hear me? I'm just going to keep talking. So we ask that people can consider these definitions that are in 320.62, and please comment if there are areas that need additional clarification or definition in your comments that you submit through public comment. Thank you.
Okay, this is Sonia Sasseville. Here's another. We've received several questions about the comment period. The comment period is established at 60 days, which ends on a Sunday. So we've been asked whether comments will be due that day or the following day. The Federal Register will identify the official date the comments on the rule are due. So reviewers should rely on the date that's provided in the Federal Register. That said, if it falls on a non-federal business day, we expect it will be the next federal business day. So just stay tuned for the Federal Register notice.
We also had a question about the market capacity study, and I guess they're asking specifically, generally, I guess just what the conclusion of the study was. And for a little background, since I don't think this was actually mentioned in the webinar, in response to Congressional Conference Committee report language, EPA prepared a report to Congress on the valuation of markets for financial responsibility instruments related to Circular 108B. And in general, the assessment suggested that the current insurance and surety markets continue to perform well and demonstrate sound financial condition, which suggests that the economic condition of the overall industry is positive, which should help support the ultimate ability of instruments industry-wide, and as well as potentially under any Circle 108B regulations. It is worth noting that, and it's noted in the study does note that, you know, these instruments, since they are responsive to a kind of a new regulatory program with a new framework, that not all of the provisions will be necessarily familiar to all the providers. And so it wasn't really possible to predict the exact market for these instruments, as it may take some time for the market to process these features. But we are definitely interested in comments as to the likely availability of the proposed instruments.
Okay, there was a question, is nitrate defined as a hazardous substance under this rule? This rule does not identify hazardous substances or modify the current designation of hazardous substances under Superfund. So none of that changes under this rule. Okay, there was another question. Does this rule affect any mine operating under a permit? So first you need to look at the overall criteria for what's in and out of the rule. Of those mines that meet the other criteria, the rule would include those mines that are authorized to operate or should be authorized to operate. So I hope that clarifies a bit.
So we had a question, looks like a couple questions about direct action. And again, direct action is at 108C of the statute. And we try to be pretty transparent and include acknowledgments of it in the instruments. And so I'd look at each instrument because it's handled, you know, maybe slightly differently across the instruments. But in general, the direct action, and this is just from the statute, provides that in instances where the owner or operator is not available, and it provides some situations, and I think bankruptcy is one of them, or just not available in the court system, then any claim that would be authorized by CERCLA, like under 107, could be taken directly to the guarantor or the instrument provider. And so I guess an example, we had a request for an example, might be a situation where a party had to do a cleanup at a facility, and the owner-operator is no longer around, and to try to get compensated for that cleanup, they could make the claim against the insurance company that had issued the Circle 108B insurance policy. So that means that it helps availability of the funds in instances where the owner-operators aren't there for any court action.
Okay, we'll continue to remind everybody that we are taking questions in that Q&A window towards the middle right of your screen. Our team is continuing to scan through the submitted questions and comments, and we'll come back on the line here in just a moment to read through a few of them in the time that we have remaining today. Again, just a reminder, some basic questions regarding today's webinar that several of you have asked. If you're looking for copies of the presentation material or that supplemental table of contents resource file, that the instructor has shared. You'll find those on the seminar resources page. If you look on the middle right of your screen under related URLs, if you scroll through there, one of the links is called Related Resources. Simply click on that and press the Browse To button to open up that website on your own computer. If you have any problems opening the website that way, you can also highlight the URL. It'll show up right next to the Browse To window. Copy and paste that into a browser as well. And then for those of you looking to earn credit, again, we do not offer formal CEUs or PDHs for today's session, but many people are able to still earn credit for attending these types of webinars by documenting their participation. We'll walk through some final instructions before we close out today with how you can document your participation as well as provide feedback and access the materials from today's session. So if you haven't done so, please take advantage of the last few moments that we have for today's live broadcast and use that Q&A window, which should appear towards the middle lower right of your screen, to privately submit your comments and questions for today's instructors. Again, they'll be continuing to review those messages as they're submitted in, and we'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted for today's webinar. Expect to have the team rejoin us here in just a moment once they've scanned through and pulled a few additional questions to read out loud.
Thanks, Jean. Also, we had another question about applicability, and this is under like subpart H, applicability for hard rock mining, in particular about there were a few classes of facilities that the agency pros would present a lower level of risk of injury and were proposing thus not to include in the provision or in the regulations. And there was a question, a couple clarification questions. One was on for a small mine of a disturbance of less than 5 acres. The question was whether that is feature specific or is that for the aggregate of the mine in total. And the 5 acres of disturbed areas is intended to be cumulative for the mine and not feature specific. The definition of disturbed acreage in acres in 320.62 could be helpful there. Although if any additional clarity is necessary, comments to that effect would be welcome. There was also a question on, for the same small mine provision, why there's an additional requirement that if a small mine not located within 1 mile of another disturbance that occurred within the prior 10 years. And there was a question about what was the intent or thinking behind that provision. And that thinking is in the preamble. It's in that universe, the hard rock mining facility section at Roman 6D1. But to paraphrase, that the concern over the potential issues that may arise from the cumulative impact of numerous small mines in close proximity is the rationale for the proposed additional qualification that any small mine not be located within a mile of another disturbance. Historically, Superfund sites with small-scale mines seem to reflect the combined environmental impacts of multiple small mines in close proximity. You know, there are examples where there are sites with numerous abandoned and inactive hard rock mining sites in close proximity. So to try to avoid those problems in the future, we wanted the small mines to be not located amongst a bunch of other small mines. And finally, this is kind of on the same vein on another class of facilities that was considered to have a lower level of risk. There were processors with less than 5 acres of surface impoundment and waste pile disturbance, and explaining how that determination was arrived at. And again, that rationale, it is in the preamble. It's in section Roman 4C of the preamble. But in short, it largely stems from kind of the research we did in the EPA's past experiences. These features were identified, the waste piles and surface impoundments have been identified as significant areas of risk at mineral processing facilities. They were contamination sources at many Superfund sites historically. They require EPA to issue imminent and substantial endangerment orders and take other enforcement actions. They resulted in natural resource damage claims. And, you know, as part of our national enforcement initiative in mining and mineral processing. The over 100 inspections taken, they found that those facilities that manage waste and large surface impoundments pose higher levels of environmental risk to human health and environment than facilities with smaller waste management units. So we wanted those features to be small or non-existent if you weren't going to be covered in the rule. We actually, another one came in on if a claimant who was successful in court and wanted payment from a surety bond, what happens in the 30 days if the owner-operator wants to appeal? And I think the question is about the payment scenario in which payment had not been made to satisfy a final judgment awarding CERCLA costs and or damages within 30 days. And and if you look at the actual wording of the instruments, the requirements for the presentation of a final judgment, and that the intent there is that any appeals process would have run its course. But again, if that's an area where that's not clear, or there's other language that we should consider, that would be a good comment. Okay, another question related to payment from the instruments has come in. Asks how situations where you could have multiple judgments against the principals, that'd be assume the implications and principals on the bond, or so against the owner-operators, how that situation would be handled. And the intent is for it to be first come, first serve. And this is discussed in the background document regarding the instrument specifications as well. And if that question was also out of some concern for claims greater than the amount of the instrument and whether that might trigger any liability on the provider, it's worth noting that what we talked about earlier, that limitation on liability in 108D, we've also intended that to be incorporated in the instruments where the limit would be to the value of the instrument.
Hey, this is Sonia. There's one, and people here can help me. There's one last thing that we will just very quickly mention is that it was identified to us that there is a typo or something along those lines in the preamble where we kind of mixed up the words regarding what facilities are in and out, and it relates to the 5 acres. So just keep an eye out. There will be a note to the file in the docket that will clarify, but it is correct in the regulatory language and in other places in the preamble. There's just one where it basically says facilities over 5 acres are out and under 5 acres are in, which obviously doesn't make sense. So just wanted to let you know that there's a mistake in there, but it's clear in the regulatory language itself. And that that concludes the 108B team's what we have to say. So, Jean, I don't have anything in closing.
All right. Well, thank you so very much. I'll walk through just a few final reminders for the live audience today before we close things out. As was mentioned, the presentation materials as well as the supplemental table of contents resource are currently available for download from the seminar homepage. I've shared that URL within the Q&A window publicly with the audience, but you'll also find it under the related URLs box on the middle right side of your page. You can simply scroll through those lists and click on the links or press the Browse To button to open up those sites. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying a recorded version of today's webinar, those links are still available and clickable through the archived version of the webinar. As noted, we are asking and encouraging all participants to share feedback during today's session. So I've also shared a link to the online feedback form. You can let us know what you thought of today's live delivery. If you happen to share the line with multiple parties, each person can fill out their own version of the feedback form. And on that form, there's a box you can check if you would like us to send you a confirmation certificate that indicated you participated in today's webinar. We do not formally issue CEUs or PDHs for our sessions, but with things such as your registration email, copies of the presentation materials, and these types of feedback confirmation certificates, that oftentimes is enough to document your participation and earn credit with your own accrediting institutions. As noted, today's session was recorded, and as soon as an archive is available for free replay, you will all receive an automatic email with instructions on how to access that session. We did have nearly, or just over 300 people join us for today's live broadcast, and I want to echo the thanks for those of you who joined us today, as well as a thanks to the CERCLA 108B rulemaking team for putting on today's session. Thank you so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.